So the thing to keep in mind is there are three basic pillars to good health. Okay? One of them is diet. One of them is exercise. And one of them is sleep. So if you maximize, you maintain healthy diet, healthy exercise, and sleep, you're most likely going to be in good shape.
Hi, I'm Pete McCall, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the All About Fitness podcast. That voice you just heard is the guest for this episode, Stanford Professor of Biology, Dr. Craig Heller. Yes, I'm rerunning this episode. This episode was originally recorded in the fall of 2020, so you may hear a couple more current references to the pandemic, but understand that's behind us now. But a couple reasons why I'm rerunning this episode. Number one, obviously it's an important topic. What you just heard in that quote is absolutely true. Nutrition, exercise, and sleep are three of the most important things that we can be doing for our health. Since I spoke with Dr. Heller at the end of 2020, I've been trying to get more sleep and trying to get half an hour extra a night. And I have to tell you, it makes a huge difference. It really does. The nights that I get 7.5, 8 hours sleep, I am firing on all cylinders the next day. The nights I get 5.5, 6 hours of sleep, not so much. That's why I'm rerunning this interview, is sleep is something we all do. And sleep is something that we can do a better job of or do more of to support our fitness goals. You might exercise. Your exercise program can be on point. Your nutrition can be awesome. But if your sleep isn't dialed in, if you don't have excellent sleep hygiene, and you'll hear Dr. Heller talk about it, you're not hitting all of your goals. You're not going to be able to hit all your goals. So sleep is one of the fundamental components of fitness that many of us can do a better job of. So with that, here we are, Dr. Craig Heller from Stanford University, Professor of Biology. And on that note, I always have fun with this because I love interviewing people from Harvard, from Stanford, from various universities, because we know the credibility these institutions have. But more importantly, I haven't kept track of it. I need to go back on my notes. I think I've interviewed more experts from Stanford. That's probably because I have a little bit of a West Coast bias. And it's always interesting to have that little West Coast, East Coast conversation. Maybe it's interesting for me, but I'm a kid of the 80s. 80s, 90s rap battles. Anyway, all that to say, there is no East Coast, West Coast battle between professors at Harvard and Stanford, but your podcast host is trying to get one started. All that to say, here we are, Dr. Craig Heller, professor of biology, expert on sleep, talking about the role that sleep should play in your fitness program if you want to dial in and nail your exercise goals. Today on the All About Fitness podcast, it is an honor to speak with Dr. Craig Heller, who is a professor of biology at Stanford. How are you doing today, Dr. Heller?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. One of the things, so your field of study is you study pretty much sleep specifically, right? Or what other areas do you study?
Well, I also study human performance and the effect of temperature on human performance. And I study the roles of sleep and circadian rhythms in learning and memory.
Interesting. How'd you get started in that? That's one question I always like asking researchers, how you got interested in the field, because obviously we all like to sleep. and as I asked this real quick, I had a college roommate who was a point guard on the basketball team. He used to sleep like 18 hours a day before his games. He'd go out and score like 40 points at night in Division III. So I didn't know if you had an affinity for sleep like he did, or how'd you get started studying sleep?
Well, I got started studying sleep literally because the animals I was doing research on didn't stay awake.
Huh.
I was studying how the brain controls body temperature. And we had these unusual animals in the lab that we were studying. And the data made no sense. And the way we were collecting the data was to put the animal in a metabolism chamber, a closed box. And we got the idea, gee whiz, maybe we should look at the animal. And sure enough, whenever they went to sleep, the responses went away. And whenever they woke up, the responses came back. So they said, well, this is really interesting. We should study sleep.
Hey, well, what can we learn? How does studying animals? This is a question I've always had, and maybe listeners have had it too, Dr. Heller, is when we study animals, how do we apply that to human physiology? Are there a lot of similarities?
Oh, yes. I mean, we are animals, and we are very closely related, of course, to other primates, but we are also related in a slightly more distant ways to other species. Now, rodents are, you know, mice and rats are frequently used in laboratory research, and they have many of the same physiological problems, diseases, genetic conditions that humans have. So it's a good way to start investigating any type of phenomenon that we're interested in with humans.
Interesting. And now you said you study circadian rhythms.
Yes.
And that's one of those things that sometimes people hear that, and it sounds, you and I are both in California. You're at Stanford, so you're in Northern California. Yeah. I'm down by San Diego. So sometimes somebody might hear circadian rhythms and think that's a little metaphysical, but what are circadian, what is the circadian biology in the human body?
Well, we literally have a clock in our brains, as do all other mammals. That clock is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, for a big word. And it essentially introduces or imposes a daily rhythm on everything in our bodies, all of our biochemistry, all of our physiology, and of course our sleep and wake. So there are certain times of the day that it's very easy to fall asleep, and other times of the day it's very difficult to fall asleep. And this is because of our circadian clock.
Interesting. And so that is a real thing. And does it,
oh, definitely.
Does light changes, does the light availability, like the sunlight, we're now recording this in the late fall or mid fall, I guess, of 2020. Yeah. And so does that affect our body naturally?
Oh, yes. It's what keeps us in tune with the real world. Our internal clocks do not have a period of exactly 24 hours. They're either a little bit longer or a little bit shorter. So, for example, one of the problems that individuals who are blind have is that their clocks are what we say free running. So they go out of sync with their social worlds. So normally, when we see light in the morning and light goes off in the evening, those are the signals that reset our brain clock to real time.
Interesting. And now, why is sleep so important? And this is one of those things where a number of years ago, I don't remember reading much about sleep back when I was a personal trainer working in health clubs in the early 2000s. But over the last maybe 8 to 10 years, Dr. Heller, it seems like I read more and more about sleep. Why has it become such an important field of study recently?
Well, I would say that it probably started to become more important in terms of the science back in about the 1950s. When the electroencephalogram first was applied to sleep. And since then, our knowledge about sleep has increased exponentially. So we do realize that we need sleep. We can go without food longer than we can go without sleep. If we do the ultimate of keep animals awake or keep humans awake over multiple days, their performance on anything you care to choose, physical performance tests or with mental performance tests or physiological tests, the performance degrades steadily. So we absolutely require sleep, and we require usually about 7 to 8 hours a night. Many people will cut sleep short. They'll sleep, you know, maybe 5 or 6 hours a night during the week and then catch up on the weekend. That doesn't quite do it. you need to have adequate sleep every day.
And what's the prevailing theory? And I want to say this very specifically for listeners, because when it comes to studying biology and studying physiology, it's true we don't know anything definitively, but we create hypotheses based on what we observe. And so right now, doctor, what are the prevailing theories about why we need sleep?
Well, there are quite a few. The function of sleep is the biggest unanswered question in all of neurobiology. And what we found in pursuing different hypotheses is that sleep has multiple functions. The most recent hypothesis, which has gained a lot of traction is that it is during sleep that we clear the trash out of our brains. And that trash is chemical trash. So that when we go to sleep, the flow of fluids between the cells of the brain increases and takes out the bits and pieces of molecules that have been discarded by the cells. Predominantly, one of the molecules is that which composes the problem with Alzheimer's disease. It's called A-beta, and the fragments of A-beta accumulate externally, external to the cells, and gets swept out of the brain during sleep. Another area of research is the role of sleep in learning and memory. We acquire information during the day, and that information is short-term memory. And then during sleep, some of that information, depending on its relevance, gets transferred to long-term memory. And this is something that has to occur during sleep. So similarly, we clean out our memory banks during sleep. Things that are less important get left behind.
Well, is that why when people have a problem or people are dealing with an issue, they say sleep on it? Is the subconscious brain still working when we're? I always look at sleep as basically like literally like shutting down and letting the body recharge overnight. But is the brain still working while we're physically asleep?
We can recharge our bodies during quiet wakefulness. We can't recharge the brain during quiet wakefulness. The physiology of the body doesn't change very much between wakefulness and sleep, but the physiology of the brain changes dramatically. So we have two stages of sleep, REM sleep and non-REM sleep. Most of our sleep, about 80% of it, is non-REM. And during non-REM, we are essentially a quiescent brain I misspoke. When we're in non-REM sleep, we have a brain which is processing information, and our body is quiescent. But when we go into REM sleep, the activity in the brain increases dramatically, and the body is paralyzed to keep us from acting out our dreams. So these two states of sleep oscillate between each other across the night in about a 90-minute period. So every 90 minutes, you go from non-REM sleep to REM and then back to non-REM sleep.
Interesting. Now, because one of the questions I have has to do with, and this, I try not to ask too many personal questions, but I'm just asking from my experience because there might be people that have the same experience. But every now and then I feel, Dr. Heller, like I'm asleep, but I might feel like I'm awake, but I can't move my body. Uh-huh. Where it's like I can kind of maybe perceive that something might be going on. Yeah. And whether I don't know if I'm in a dream or what, but I have, from what I've read, that has to do with the fact that I know, as you just mentioned, the body is kind of held in a stasis during REM sleep. What's happening with that? What's the mechanism that's causing that to occur?
Essentially, the brain is paralyzing our muscles during REM sleep to keep us from acting out our dreams. There is a medical problem called REM sleep disorder. And in REM sleep disorder, you may have a situation like you've described in which you actually wake up, but the paralysis of the muscles is still present. And therefore, you feel that you're awake, but you can't move. There's also the opposite, and that is that the muscle paralysis component of REM turns off before you wake up. And in that sort of a situation, you can actually have some violent movements that can do damage to the body or do damage to a sleeping partner.
Hmm. That's interesting. And the other question I have, because when I was reading through some of your work, I saw that adenosine is one of the substances that circulates in the brain. Yeah. And for listeners, adenosine is a component of adenosine triphosphate, which is the actual chemical that fuels muscle contraction.
Right.
And this occurs, doctor, when I was a competitive rugby player and when I do like a really hard workout or I do something new or I'm doing a competition,
there's sometimes when I'm trying to fall asleep and my body will spasm, my muscles will spasm. And my theory on that, and this is just my hypothesis, is that that's like leftover acetylcholine, which is the chemical that fires the synaptic gap for muscle contraction. What's happening with that when we sometimes spasm? Because I'm sure listeners, if they're active, might have some of the same things of when their body, I mean, do you know what I'm talking about? Is that a relatively common occurrence? And what I've referred to it is, it's kind of like an engine knocking after a long car trip. The engine's still warm, and so it's going to knock as it cools down a little bit. Am I right with that at all? I mean, again, that's just my hypothesis.
Well, there are a number of causes of muscle spasms, and after very vigorous exercise, it's most likely an electrolyte imbalance. But cramps, which occur during performance, they are because of temperature. So the temperature of the muscle goes above a safe level, and the best way to get that muscle to stop is to throw a cramp at it.
Interesting. And that's where, because that's where the sports drinks come in, right? Because the sports drinks help hydrate the muscle a little bit more efficiently, correct?
Well, they provide hydration and they provide some electrolytes, but there's also a lot of hype about sports drinks.
Well, what I learned a long time ago was a little bit of sea salt, and maybe a little bit of natural sugar is all you really need in a thing of water if you really want a good like electrolyte drink. And would I be accurate in that?
Well, pretty close, yeah.
I mean, that's basically what it is. Well, let's talk temperature control for a second, because you said that's one of the things you study.
Yes.
What happens to the temperature of our body during when we sleep? What happens during that, and what do we need to pay attention to?
We also have a thermostat in our brains. We talked about the clock in the brains. There's also a thermostat. And that thermostat turns down when you go to sleep. It turns down on a circadian basis. So even if you stay awake, your body temperature will fluctuate with a period of 24 hours. But when you go to sleep, that thermostat is turned down even more. And you probably have had the experience in which you're really cold in the evening. You go to bed, you cover yourself with a comforter and blankets, and 15 minutes later, you wake up sweating. Because not only have you insulated yourself to feel comfortable, but your thermostat has gone down. So now you have to lose the heat in order to be comfortable. So that's one of the benefits of the temperature-controlled beds. It enables you to program the bed to compensate for that readjustment of your thermostat. So by the bed becoming a little cooler, it prevents you from waking up and sweating. So you probably had the experience, too, of in the morning feeling chilly. And in the morning, your thermostat starts back up again before you wake up.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So that your body temperature is higher at wake-up time than it was during the middle of the night. So the thermostatic bed can be programmed to have a profile that creates an environment that is suitable to these changes in the setting of your thermostat, your brain thermostat.
And I know that's some of the new technology that's been introduced with mattresses and like having smart mattresses. And yeah. Is that the theory that you can have a mattress that regulates your temperature overnight to reduce the wake-ups?
That's right. I like to use the example of traveling to Europe in the summer. And what you find is the hotels still have big, heavy comforters on the beds, Federbetten. And so you're hot, okay, because the rooms are not air conditioned, and you have this big, thick comforter on you. So what do? You stick out your hands and your feet, right? And that's how you lose heat to the environment. But it's not necessarily the optimal way to sleep. So what the temperature-controlled bed does is it changes the environment, the thermal environment that you're sleeping in order to make you more comfortable. And of course, if you're more comfortable, you will sleep better.
And so let's talk a little bit about sleep hygiene real quick. I mean, you mentioned earlier that the recommendation, is it 6 to 8 hours or 7 to 8 hours in terms of duration?
7 to 8 hours is generally the if you're left to your own devices without any schedules, most people will get between 7 and 8 hours of sleep. And that's assuming they spend 8 to 9 hours in bed.
Interesting. So that's including a little bit of time before bed, like doing some reading and some wind down, and then a little bit of time. What we do nowadays, unfortunately, I think a lot of us do this, is grab our phone and doom scroll before we get out of bed and to see to check the news.
That is really bad.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Because one of the things with the circadian clock that I told you is that it is reset by light, and predominantly by blue light. So when you expose yourself to blue light at bedtime, what that does is phase delays your clock. So it's as if it's earlier in the evening and you're not ready to go to sleep yet. So exposure to blue light in the evening is not conducive to falling asleep at a regular time.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I had read about that, and I'm making a joke about the doom scrolling, because I've really, the last about 4 to 6 weeks, I've really made a conscious effort to not look at my phone first thing in the morning, because just of the way that starts the day. But the one thing I was doing was I was reading on my iPad in bed before going to sleep, and I had read an article about that. And so since then, I've switched to the old-fashioned analog books, and I have found personally, just out of experience, that sleep is happening easier without having, even though I'd set the iPad to be more favorable for that, I found that switching to the analog books. So sometimes technology can work against us for that. But what are some other tips for getting a good, for being able to get to sleep well without needing to use any type of aids?
Well, there are a number, and they constitute a body of knowledge which is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And this is a much better way of treating insomnia or sleep difficulties than taking sleeping pills. So one of the things is, just as we said, keep the bedroom for sleep and sex, not for doing work. Don't have your computer on. Don't have your television on in the bedroom before you go to sleep. Stop working a couple hours before sleep. Make sure that you have your dinner not too late, so that you're not going to bed with a full stomach. These all are just common sense things that lead to healthier sleep, that allow our bodies to express their healthy pattern of behavior. So people who practice and have a regular scheduled time to go to bed and to wake up, so that you are maintaining that connection between your circadian clock and your sleep homeostat, the system which is regulating the depth and the pattern of your sleep. So, yeah, just by using common sense, we can do an awful lot to improve our quality of sleep.
And the one thing I saw that you studied, doctor, is our arousal states. And I think that's an interesting area, because I mean this arousal in a non-amorous way. Obviously, we're talking about the bedroom, and that's a whole different conversation. Yeah. But what exactly are, because in the morning, for example, for listeners, my understanding is, just like you said, our body temperature starts warming up. That's cortisol, one of the hormones that starts releasing energy in the body. But what are arousal states, and what role do they play with exercise and with human performance?
Right. Arousal states are just a different way of describing sleep and wake. So we have two arousal states in sleep, REM and non-REM. We also divide the non-REM into additional stage one, stage two, stage three, which represent the depth of sleep. So wakefulness is an arousal state. REM sleep is an arousal state. Non-REM sleep stages one, two, three are arousal states. So that's all that word means. It essentially is referring to the arousability of our brains. Are they awake? Are they asleep? How deeply asleep are they? And so forth.
Interesting. And so when should we exercise when related to sleep? Because I know some people might only have late in the day. They might be very busy, and they might think getting to the gym at later, like 8:30 in the evening, might help them wind down. But is there a recommendation based on the physiology? And you talked earlier about kind of wanting to have a set pattern before going to bed. But some listeners out there might just, that might be the only time they can find to make it to the gym.
Well, the question is what kind of exercise? So if that exercise is highly competitive, you know, like a basketball game, then you're not only dealing with temperature, you're dealing with the fact that you've gotten your hormones all revved up, your emotions all revved up, and that has to calm down. But if it's exercise on a fixed bike or weights, then your temperature may go up, and it will help you to cool down before you go to sleep. If in on the other hand, you're cold, sometimes a warm bath will promote early onset sleep. So, you know, there are multiple factors that interact. The thing to keep in mind is there are three basic pillars to good health. Okay? One of them is diet. One of them is exercise. And one of them is sleep. So if you maximize, you maintain healthy diet, healthy exercise, and sleep, you're most likely going to be in good shape. Different medications that are used to treat sleep. One whole class are called benzodiazepines, and they all affect a particular type of ion channel in the brain. They do not produce normal sleep. They definitely promote sleep, but they don't promote normal sleep. And by normal sleep, I mean sleep that has the characteristic EEG signature. Now, the other problem with the benzodiazepines is they tend to develop tolerance. In other words, you start having to take more and more of them, and that's really unhealthy. One of the most common additions to medicines these days that promote sleep are what are called antihistamines. So histamine is another brain chemical that maintains wakefulness or promotes wakefulness. And antihistamines cut that back a little bit. And that's why, you know, if you are taking antihistamines, the bottle says, do not take these if you're using heavy equipment or driving, because they'll tend to promote sleep. But, you know, taking an ibuprofen with that they label ibuprofen PM or one of the other nociceptives or anti-inflammatory drugs that say PM on them. This means they also have a little bit of antihistamine in them, and that helps promote sleep.
Yeah, I was wondering that because I have a daughter who's allergic to peanuts. She has a pretty severe peanut allergy. And so I'll carry Benadryl. I carry Benadryl with me sometimes when we're out and about. And I was looking at the package, and I saw a and it was a package of my ex-wife. This is when we were living together, had some of those I think Unisom over the counter or whatever they are, sleep pills. And I saw that it was the same, basically the same ingredient. It was dye something D something something that was the same ingredient in both Benadryl and the sleep in the sleep aid. And I was. That just kind of, so that's what that's happening. So a histamine will help keep us awake, but the antihistamine, yeah. Is that what's happening there?
Right. Yeah.
Okay, great. Anything to add about what we should know about sleep? I mean, if, because one of the things I like to do, doctors, what I try to do with a podcast is help people understand how to use exercise to mitigate the effects of the aging process. And is there, as we get a little bit older into our 40s and 50s, should we be paying more attention to our sleep and trying to get better quality sleep?
Oh, absolutely. Sleep, as I said, is absolutely essential. And doesn't matter what age you are, sleep is essential. And cutting sleep short endangers your body in many different ways. I mean, it compromises your immune system. It can result in increased blood pressure. It can result in metabolic problems such as risk for diabetes. So you have to keep in mind that the body runs in two different ways, wakefulness and sleep. And the things that we need to do and have active during wakefulness are the things that get turned off during sleep and restored. So the restorative properties of sleep definitely are for the brain, but they also apply to the body as well. So, for example, growth hormone is a hormone that's essential for all sorts of building processes in the body. And growth hormone is released during sleep. If you don't sleep, you don't get the release, the daily release of growth hormone. But critical are the processes in the brain that are responsible for our learning and memory. Information acquired during the day has to be consolidated. It has to be integrated with the existing information in the brain. And this occurs during sleep.
Sorry to cut in here, but as you say that, I just got this image, doctor, that like sleep is a time when I'm taking what I kind of went through during the day and downloading that to my hard drive, or I'm offloading that from, exactly. If we use our brain as a desktop, then sleep is when I'm taking that data and kind of shoveling it back to a hard. Is that an accurate?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Yeah. And then finally, what role does napping play? Is there a benefit to catching? I've heard, I heard Brandon Marcello, a PhD, talk about the benefit of napping, and he gave a recommendation. I'm sipping a cup of coffee while we record this, and he gave a recommendation one time that I thought was very interesting. He said, if you drink a little bit of coffee and then you close your eyes for about a 15 to 20 minute cat nap, the caffeine hasn't kicked in yet, but then when you wake up, it'll kind of metabolize into your body. So that's one thing. And I don't know whether that's accurate, but I just thought that was an interesting side note. But what role does napping play? Is there a benefit to catching a half hour nap at some point during the day?
Well, I would imagine that cat nap would have to be pretty short because the caffeine gets in pretty quickly.
So
sure, there are benefits to a short nap. Long naps are probably not that good. But naps, so this is a little bit difficult to answer because we don't know fully the functions of REM and non-REM sleep. Okay, so if you get a nap, you get non-REM sleep predominantly without the REM. So some studies have shown that you don't get enhanced memory benefits from a nap. That sleep during the day is not the same as sleep at night. So definitely a nap is healthy in that it relaxes the body and clears out the brain, but it probably is not compensating for loss of nighttime sleep.
So somebody, go ahead.
Mind, there is this clock mechanism and there is the sleep mechanism, and the two are working together.
I'm getting that image of somebody who thinks, oh, I'll go out at night and then I'll just catch a nap during the day to try to make up for it. And I don't think you might have been able to get away with that early in your 20s. But I think, I don't know about as I get older and if I miss a night of sleep for some reason, usually because of travel or usually because of time, you know, and I haven't traveled for 7 months, but I've been doing a lot of work in Asia the last few years. I have found, doctor, that if I miss a night of sleep now, it takes me about 3 to 5 days to catch up, as opposed to in my early 20s. Is that pretty consistent, pretty accurate?
It is, and it's even worse than that. Let me give you an example of a wonderful experiment that has been done. People have been put on short night schedules. So they could either be in bed for 9 hours, for 7 hours, for 5 hours, and so forth. And then during the day, they are given performance tests. And what you see is the decay in the performance with let's say, 5 nights of restricted sleep, like a work week. The performance decay is directly related to the loss of sleep. Now, here is the amazing thing. You then put those individuals back on a normal sleep schedule, in other words, restorative sleep, catching up on the weekend. And their performance improves. But the more sleep they have lost, the greater the, well, let me put it this way, they don't come back up to the level of the individuals that had the 9 hours in bed. Okay?
Wow,
So it takes more than 2 days to recover. Moreover, if they take those individuals and put them then back on the short sleep schedule, what they find is after only the first night, they're back down at the bottom level that they were after the 5 days of sleep restriction previously. Wow. So there's a long-term deficit that is associated with short sleep. And it doesn't work to have short sleep during the week and then sleep in on the weekend.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And then the final thing that before we wrap up here is you mentioned earlier about growth hormone. And this is one thing that I lecture about quite a bit. I do a lot of education workshops for personal trainers. And my understanding is we produce growth hormone and testosterone, our anabolic hormones. We produce them during the REM cycles of sleep. Am I correct with that?
Well, I don't know if you could say REM. Definitely during sleep. It's very difficult to sort out the direct effects of REM and non-REM. One of the reasons is a technique that's been used is REM deprivation. You know, you allow people to have non-REM sleep, but they can have REM sleep. But the problem with that is that the longer you have gone without non-REM, the greater is your propensity to go into non-REM. Mm. As a result, the longer you've been without REM sleep, the greater is the need for REM, the greater is the propensity to enter REM, and that compromises the quality of the non-REM. So it's very difficult to sort out what is happening specifically in REM, what's specifically happening in non-REM sleep.
Because I appreciate that, because one of the things I try to get trainers and other coaches thinking about is on Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays is asking their clients and asking their workout participants, do you have plans in the evening? Because if you're coming to me for a Friday workout, doctor, and you tell me that you and your wife have tickets to the theater at night, and I know that you maybe are going to go out and have an extra glass of wine, or you're going to go out and maybe stay out a little bit later than normal, and I know your sleep is going to be disrupted, that's not going to be the day that I give you your hardest workout. I'm not going to push you that hard because I know your sleep is going to be disrupted that night. Should people pay attention to that, kind of balance their workout intensity with their plans at night? Because whereas if you told me that your plans for Friday night were just to watch Netflix and hang out and maybe get Chinese food, I might push you a little bit harder in the gym that day. Am I thinking along the right lines with that?
Well, I guess the problem is if you're going to the concert, are you more likely to fall asleep in the concert or not?
Okay, I'm glad I'm not the only one. I love the theater. Going to the theater after a meal, and man, I'm people are singing to me. It's dark and I'm comfy, but
we certainly see that in our performance experiments on students. You know, we can always tell when it's midterm time or when they've been out partying on the weekend. Their performance definitely goes down.
No, that's interesting. But am I right with that, though? If I'm going to be working with somebody, I'm doing a workout like on a Friday or Saturday, and say I have plans for that night, I'm going to a party and I'm going to be out later than normal, maybe not have an extra drink or two than normal that's going to disrupt my sleep, I shouldn't really work out. That shouldn't be my hardest workout if I know my sleep isn't going to be normal, if I'm going to have disrupted sleep that night. Am I correct in that?
I can't answer that. There are too many variables.
Okay.
What you're doing.
I appreciate that. And again, I appreciate that because you just don't know. You don't know the individual and you don't know what variables are in there. So I totally.
Right. And once again, it's the nature of the exercise as well. You know, is it something which gets you really worked up and aggressive? Or is it something which is just monotonous physical work? So
that's true. Yeah, because running, whether running is a little bit more steady state versus an interval type workout, that's going to have a different response. Yeah, you're right. There's a very different response. Well, to wrap it up, if we can pay attention to our temperature and control our temperature when we sleep, that can help us get a better quality sleep, correct?
Yes, that's true. Put it this way, in a cool environment, it's a lot easier to lose heat than it is in a warm environment. So your body is trying to go to a lower level, and in the warm environment, that's more difficult to do. So definitely the early sleep, the onset of sleep is going to be compromised if you're in a too hot environment or a too cold environment. So
And this is the time of year I love in California because we're getting the cool evenings. Yes. And you open up the window and I don't know, just that fresh air, that cool evening. And yeah. I can tell there's a much, much better quality of sleep. And that has to be the reason for it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, Dr. Craig Heller, a professor of biology at Stanford University, I greatly appreciate your time today. And I greatly appreciate the insights on the science and the biology of sleep.
Good. Well, good luck.
As I said, you know, I know exercise, I know fitness, I know how exercise changes the body. The areas I need to get better at as a professional are in nutrition and sleep. And really, when I make an emphasis on sleep, when I make an approach to sleep, if I make a specific focus on it, I feel so much better. I feel my training gets better, my workouts are awesome, but that's why I'm rerunning this episode, is sleep is the one thing that we all do, yet if we want to really nail our fitness goals and really want to do what we want to do with our time in the gym, we have to take a mindful approach to sleep. We can't just check off the box, get 4 or 5 hours and think we're getting enough. We need to take a mindful approach, and this conversation can help you understand that. Hey, with that, you can reach out to me, Pete, at PeteMcCallFitness.com. That's Pete at PeteMcCallFitness.com. Thank you for stopping by, and I do look forward to having you join me for future episodes of All About Fitness.